Hey there, Kelly here. Guests on the show share so many great ideas, but how do you start putting them into practice? Well, that's exactly what you'll explore when you sign up for the Podcast Weekly Newsletter. Each week, you'll get 3 ideas from past guests sent straight to your inbox. You'll explore materials, techniques, tools, concepts, and mindsets in bite-sized pieces so that you can think about them and fold them into your own practice. It's completely free, and you get it by signing up at learntopaintpodcast.com/newsletter.
If there's a sense of danger and challenge, especially at the beginning where you've got no preconceived ideas, something will happen that you haven't accounted for that just might be your springboard to your style or something tangibly different from the norm.
Hello and welcome to the Learn to Paint podcast, the show where we work to answer the question, how do you get better at painting? I'm your host, Kelly Ann Powers, with the voice you just heard, acrylic painter Hashim Akib. In this 50th episode conversation, you'll discover a unique way to mix your acrylic paints, how to look beyond your local influences, and you'll explore strategies you can use to create looser work. Gloss and High Gloss Art Club members, in your bonus conversation, we'll dive into drawing, what you can do with your reference photos, and a whole lot more. Plus, you've got access to an additional 15 bonus conversations in your library. I'd especially recommend the bonus conversation with episode 44 guest Jose Trujillo. In it, he talks about how he approaches his references so that he can literally paint anything, and I found the idea really liberating. If you're not a member of the Podcast Art Club but would like to be, learn more at learntopaintpodcast.com/artclub. Also, on this 50th episode of the show, I want to say a huge thank you to everyone listening and supporting the podcast. Podcast Art Club members, it's been amazing getting to hang out with you during the 20 for 20 Art Challenge and seeing all your great work and reading all of your incredible thinking. All right, here we go.
Hi, Hash. Welcome to the podcast. How did you get started in art?
Hi, Kelly. Thanks for inviting me, by the way. I've always done art. I've been an illustrator for quite a few years, working for advertising, design, and editorial campaigns. That was probably half my career. And then the other half, I decided to just move into fine art a little bit more. I didn't particularly like the deadlines of illustration. So I thought the slightly freer approach to painting as a fine artist would be a lot more to my liking. But I've found it's actually even more commercial, I guess, when you start off and you can't turn that tap off. It's constant. But I much prefer doing my own thing, not so many rules and regulations as illustration was. But yeah, so now I'm a fine artist and I teach. I've written some books. I write for an art magazine here in the UK, and I'm represented by some galleries. So I get to do a bit of everything.
How did you find acrylics specifically?
I noticed when I was at college, there was a bit of a hierarchy of mediums. And oil was the most expensive paintings to buy, if you like. I also noticed a lot of my peers were moving into oils. I think that was down to the fact that a lot of tutors were recommending them. And I just thought, just do something a bit different. I'd heard of acrylics. When I started with them, they weren't as advanced as they are now. You can get so much stuff now. So I really liked the fact that there was no baggage, or not as much baggage with them as oil painting. So when I think of oil painters, I always think of the greats, artists from the Renaissance and Impressionism. So I like the fact that when I thought of acrylics, it was a bit of a blank slate. There's a few artists, Peter Blake, Bridget Riley, but I really like the idea that I wasn't seemingly influenced by a long line of great artists. So I really like the uniqueness of them, and they're forgiving as well.
What does acrylics as a medium allow you to do?
Okay, I really like the fact that my personality suits them. Or I see the personality of the paint, if you like. The fast drying allows me to work really quick. And I like the idea of seeing something, getting the thunderbolt of the inspiration of seeing something, and being able to represent that quite quickly. So I don't like the idea of drying times over days or weeks, because by then I would have moved on mentally. And I like the fact that it's condensed and my thought processes are very fluid and there's a momentum behind the painting. So I think that's the main aspect to acrylics I like. Also, I'm quite busy, so I like the fact that I can do multiple things over a shorter period of time, which I find commercially that suits me really well. But I think certainly the quick drying time reflects my lack of patience now as I get older.
I know you said you were an illustrator and then you moved into painting as fine art. Was there a point in that path where you sort of realized, like, I've been doing this, but I want to take it seriously? Was there a change in how you approached it?
Yeah, I have to say, initially, my only influences were kind of local artists who did a very particular thing. And where I live, it's by the sea, so lots of pictures of boats. And I've got nothing against that. It can be a bit cheesy and chocolate boxy. And a lot of artists in the UK do that kind of stuff. So I just assumed I'd end up being one of those long line of artists who did that kind of thing. And it wasn't till I started really going to a couple of galleries, quite good galleries, and I wanted to find my place in the art world. And at the time, one of the galleries really wasn't so keen on that chocolate box kind of harbor scene with seagulls. And she much preferred a looser, slightly more contemporary approach. So that was the light switch that really turned me on to thinking outside of my little bubble. And literally that meeting just transformed the way I just took everything. I did things quickly. It was more about learning quick, getting things done quick. And then I realized that I could then do multiple things. So it wasn't that kind of long-winded technical approach that I was influenced by anymore. It was much more looser brushstrokes and just treating things a little bit more expressively. So I found that was a real catalyst for the way I saw things and I saw my place in the art world.
Especially if you're seeing something all the time and then make a conscious break from the thing you're seeing around you all the time. I imagine that was pretty uncomfortable, or did it just feel good?
It felt really good. Although what tends to happen is the moment you deviate from the norm, or what many people might consider the norm, you definitely get some slack from maybe people around you. At the time, I was running a couple of weekly workshops, and there was a particular remit for that, just to kind of, I guess, what was the norm, semi-realistic, concentrating on the mechanics of painting. So I did notice when I started moving into a slightly more expressive route, some of my students were quite critical, and I had nothing to measure against. So that was quite tricky. It felt good. It felt right for me. I started exploring color, mark making. I was looking at other artists as well, which deviated from the kind of artist I was looking at. And I did notice certainly either my peer group or my students were more critical and said, don't do that. You should stick to these lovely harbor scenes. But I had faith, or I certainly thought, let's give it a try and see what happens. And I took the plunge, actually. I just stopped running those classes. Quite a severe cut. I just said, no more, and I'll do a monthly one. And that transformed everything because I had more time to then explore these new way of painting for me. And that's when I started taking it out and showcasing it more. I entered some competitions, exhibitions, galleries, and I had so much more of an impact than my realistic stuff. I mean, it was literally overnight that when I got this work out, it just had a more unique voice to it rather than the traditional aspect of the previous work.
Did you have to completely relearn your process?
No, it's really weird. I used to spend about 3 to 4 weeks on one painting. So the guy at college, the main tutor who I really kind of looked up to, he was a realistic watercolorist and he would paint every single brick, every single leaf. So that's what I associated great art to be. And you had to suffer as well. That was the other thing. So all I did was I shortened the process. So rather than starting off with small brushes, I started using bigger brushes. And I thought, well, if I block things in with a big brush and then at the end, I can spend my requisite 3 weeks finishing with a little brush. But I just found the early marks just worked really well to contrast the little marks. And especially this gallery owner who saw this more expressive work, she really reinforced that idea that, well, actually, as a painting, it's more interesting as a representation of the artist's kind of potted history of the painting, having some loose marks, some spontaneous marks, some very finished marks. So it's not as if I just jettisoned drawing and didn't do little bricks and leaves. I just took out a few hundred of them and just placed a few in the right places, I suppose.
So then let's just back up a little bit. So for people who may not know your work, you paint in acrylics. What type of acrylics do you use?
I particularly like heavy body. When I started off, I was using Liquitex super heavy body paint, which is, I mean, it's like concrete. It's so thick. You put it on, it stays there. There's hardly any shrinkage. So I used that as a way of relinquishing detail because the paint was so thick. You really couldn't get a little rigger brush out and move it around because it was just so puny against this weighty paint. So I used that for quite a bit of time. I did also use a medium to reduce the weight of it if I did want to lay it on thinner, but it was all about the thickness, the weight. And that also made me not layer the paint so much because the paint was so thick that you couldn't add multiple layers on it. So literally it was, I don't know, maybe one or two, three layers at the very most, just to get used to seeing how paintings work just off the paint. I remember actually going to an exhibition in London at Tate Britain and seeing an exhibition by Pierre Bonnard, who's a post-impressionist. And it's the first time I was acutely aware of paint hanging off canvas. So if you see a lot of art in books, you don't really get the full effect of certainly an artist who likes piling it on. And I thought that really kind of focused my attention on how a painting can be kind of physically interactive rather than just kind of visually. That really pushed me towards a thicker weight of paint. And I still use a relatively thick paint now. It's a heavy body paint. I'd certainly stop using the super heavy because when you start doing commissions or when you start doing some refined detail, it's going to slightly interfere with if you want something slightly more precise. So it's a heavy body paint, which you can obviously thicken up with an additive or you can thin down with a retarder or medium.
When you were making that transition from more realism to more abstracted, were you consciously setting up challenges for yourself in the sense of like obstacles to realism to like force you to try to be more abstract?
Yeah, I'm definitely prone to overworking and adding more detail than I need. That's only because it's so ingrained and so embedded in my system that I remember when I was younger, I was extremely keen to showcase that I could do a straight line everywhere and that level of precision. Because I really like mechanics. I really like the idea that you have a mastery of something that you're showing off. And especially when you're young or if you're starting out, you have this preconceived idea that that is what people want to see. So I definitely started timing my work. So I'd do some portraits under an hour just to see what happened. And at whatever stage it was, that was the finished version. And I was really surprised that after a certain amount of time, I really liked the quick portraits that I was doing. And I definitely subconsciously became quicker at and being analytical about what's important, what I can leave out. So like, obviously I'd bring the eyes out and the background, or maybe some of the rest of the landscape of the face would just be left to just fade away. And then you really get into it and you really start to think, how quickly can I make these paintings work? I also did little things like I experimented with color a little bit more. It's a really peculiar thing because I know when I was at college, I absolutely detested abstract. I thought it was just an excuse not to draw or paint properly. But I mean, I've completely changed and I really appreciate the fact that some people like paintings for color. Some people don't want to be dictated to by heightened levels of detail and everything sledgehammered. So I really appreciate, and especially as I get older, my tastes change and I'm much more emotionally engaged with what I'm doing. So I want to enjoy what I do. And that reflects in the lack of detail because that is much more technical and much more demanding. Your perception kind of mindset.
And also what I hear you saying is that part of trying something new is learning how to assess it with new eyes. Because if you're trying something new but assessing it by the old standards, it's going to fail every time. Like you had to actually learn how to like know when a painting was done, but through a new lens.
Yeah, I have to say, I mean, at the time I was on the cusp of getting a normal job anyway, or teaching full time. I had taken a job at the local university and I was on my way to, if I stayed there long enough, I'd be head of art by now with a cushy job doing lots of admin. But I was acutely aware that if I didn't change something about the way I was working, I really wasn't going to get very far. So it's funny, I've definitely noticed that when my back's up against the wall, that's when your instincts really kick in and the way you function and the way you work and what you need to do is much more palpable. There's an immediacy about it. And I've noticed, you know, when you run workshops, obviously it should be relaxed and it should be enjoyable, but a little bit of pressure now and again actually really heightens those senses. And I really related how I was feeling and how palpable I felt the options of what was left for me were narrowing if I didn't do something dramatic. So yeah, I whatever it took to stay in art, I really embraced.
From your acrylic standpoint, how important in acrylics is like professional versus standard or student grade?
I tend to use both. When I started selling a lot more, I moved on to Golden, which I mean, it's the pinnacle, I guess, of what most people consider the absolute best acrylics you can get. The amount of pure pigment in the paint, especially artist quality. I did find I felt inhibited by using a lot of it because it was so expensive. So I started using some student grade to get me going and then finish with artist quality. And over time, I just noticed none of my clients or none of the gallery owners ever said, right, you stop using student grade because we can tell. So no one's ever mentioned it. So I just continued to use my student grade. I tend to use artist quality for the lighter colors like yellows, orange, and white, definitely. But all the darker tones, your blues, your greens, muddy violet, they're all student grade, but I use it very neat. So I don't water it down and I don't feather it and play with it. I apply it as neat as possible and it comes out fairly pure in terms of the paint.
Well then, how many colors do you generally use?
I think I use quite a bit. It's funny because I definitely understand artists recommending limited palettes and kind of slowly immersing yourself into color and looking at tonal ranges. But I just dived in. I just thought, hang on, I've got to learn this really quick. And at the time, I didn't really know names of colors. I just thought, I like that green. And I just crowded my palette full of color. And I just really enjoyed applying it. Even the way I was color mixing was apparently unconventional, because in color mixing, there's a rule where the most colors you ever mix together any one time is three colors. That's to avoid creating muddy messes and what have you. But I at least have three colors and then more, because I really like the idea that I'll definitely produce some, I mean, obviously hideous looking paintings to start off with. But over time, I'll calibrate it and I'll start to ease it down. So it's kind of like you're either going to learn diving in the deep end or you're going to do it slowly over the course of time. But because time was limited, a very limited resource at the time, I just thought I'd put loads of colors in, whatever colors I got, put them in. And I created this slightly unique, I guess it's unique to me, this color mixing where I get my brush and I dip it in several colors at any one time. And they don't even have to be harmonious. They could be a green with a red and an orange. But the only thing is that I don't overmix it when I mix it on my mixing tray. I go straight on and I just see what happens. And then I can calm it down later on. It's just a way of learning about color fairly quickly by just making a mess. I've seen kids do it. So I think they're onto something.
Then did you really consciously decide like, okay, let's jump in? And then if yes, how did you deal with the high risk, high reward of that style of learning?
I don't think I even was consciously aware that I was making mistakes. I remember when I was doing realistic work, I was very much into tonal ranges. So a bit of color, but it would be a dark green next to a light green. And I was aware that I had to learn about color and I had to be conscious of learning. So I did read some books, some basic color theory books. I wanted to know something of the science behind color. And also, I think it's quite good to know what the rules are, if you like, in color mixing and certain artists recommend some palettes. And I've also noticed things like you're meant to start off with more passive colors. So when you buy a set of oils or watercolors or acrylics, the box that you get tends to cover the gamut of more passive colors because they're more kinder to mixes. So I kind of thought, okay, well, we're going to leave that behind and we're going to go for very dominant colors. So I wasn't even conscious of, okay, well, if I use a soft green against a heightened green or a kind of cool yellow against a warm red, none of that happened. I just learned through practical experience and a little bit of theory kind of peppered in. And because I was very motivated, I mean, I did a lot and I just drove through it. I mean, I was still drawing well, so they might have looked horrendous color-wise, but the drawing was immaculate. And over the course, like say, of time, you just gauge it a little bit better in terms of some color schemes.
materials are a big topic, and it's, you know, in part because we use them to paint. But do you think that as beginners, we get too caught up in the idea of a magic material, like a material fixing all of our painting problems?
Yeah, personally, I do. If you're strapped for cash, as I was many years ago, I just had to work with what I had, and it was the crummiest materials you could find. And the canvases I was using were kind of like tissue paper. They were horrible. So I'm not really big on, you know, you have to get these things in order for you to magically transform into an amazing painter. Because I think a lot of it starts with confidence, your passion, your motivation, what you want to get from it. Some people do art just as a, you know, because they want to meet people. So I'm really conscious that there's all manner of opinions as to why someone wants to do it. But I don't think, you know, the magic ingredient is you've got to get this brush or this color. There's certain colors I don't want to live without, for example. I don't think, you know, you give me whatever colors and I'll try and do something constructive with it. But yeah, material wise, I know if people are on a budget, I'll tell them, okay, you can get this basic range that get you going. And if you like what you see, start going up a notch. Obviously, if you've got tons of disposable income, you know, I can recommend, you know, all the ranges. But yeah, generally people starting out, yeah, don't get caught up with the material. Get caught up with more of a mental outlook and what you want to achieve.
Well, then, yeah, what is that basic? Like if someone said to you, like, I want to get started in acrylics, but I don't have much money. I'm still trying to figure out if it's the right medium for me. What is sort of the basics that you would suggest to them?
I tend to offer something slightly different from the norm because I don't want to force feed representational art, because that's something you'll get better at the more you paint and the more you draw. If you want to draw well, you're going to have to sit there and draw something, preferably from life, for a considerable amount of time. Even if you've got some natural talent, you still have to harness that and kind of mold it. But if you're just starting out, you just really need a tiny set of, I don't know, 5 colors. With any medium, you need the primary colors, a couple of brushes, and something to work on, paper or canvas. I tend to recommend relatively large brushes, and anyone starting out, you probably need a handful of paintings just to see if you like the medium, how forgiving it is and how you respond. But in terms of what you start off with, I think just a handful of colors and just an aptitude for an open mind and kind of just be open to something other than just drawing realistically.
Well, then you mentioned the mindset is almost more important than the materials. What's the mindset that's sort of ideal for that?
I think it's really valuable to let someone know about the kind of goals you might want to set yourself. I really vividly remember at college, like a tutor would say, oh, you got potential. And I'd say, how do I use that? What do I do? Tell me what I should aim for. So let's say you see someone and they turn up and they've got no idea. And then they start painting and you realize they've got an aptitude for color. I'd say one of two things to them. I'd say, you're really good at color, so you might want to improve your drawing. Or, you're really good at color, why don't you think of doing paintings where you really harness that potential? So you do paintings based around what colors you like and like the design of color. There's a guy who started with me, had no experience, and he's the best I've ever seen at laying paint down in a super confident way. Because what you'll find is, especially with beginners, when they use a big brush and they load a brush up, which also can be taxing, when that brush comes in to land on the canvas, they normally start shaking and there's a lot of turbulence because they're nervous, you know, don't know if they're going to do the right thing. But this guy, he just went straight to it, picked up paint, slapped it on. So he already had this idea that I'm just going to let myself go. I'm just going to see what happens. And at the very least, at the end, there'll be a very clear overriding effect of that painting where the marks are super confident. It didn't even matter whether he could draw or not. It was so, I believe, every single mark he was applying. And you see the same with color. It's normally the people who go in and they're scared and they're worried. They want to seek approval. They have a preconception that they have to draw something out and then color it in with a tiny brush. So I think the mindset, just go in, just don't consider anything, go in and just see what happens. And then you can judge. If you've got someone who knows something about art, then they will say, maybe pursue this, or you're really good at drawing, don't do much drawing for the next few months, just do some painting, just explore color. So I think that mindset, just being a bit more open-minded initially, I think is really important.
We're going to move into your process a little bit. Could you walk us through your process?
I did literally used to draw and then color in with a very, very small brush. And that was it. It didn't go anywhere. It's from the start, I knew what was happening. So now it's completely different. Don't do any drawing. The best way to encapsulate it is chaos into order. I really go in, all guns blazing, no preconceived ideas, big brush. I've got an idea of where it's going color-wise. And my drawing, I trust my drawing as the foundation of my being, if you like. My creative being. So I trust my drawing's going to kick in, but maybe a bit later on. So I'll just get an overall impression, generally with midtones and color, and then I'll start pounding it into some kind of definition. And then at the end is when I get maybe a smaller brush out and refine it and fine tune it to the point where I feel I don't need to put everything in and I leave something to the imagination where the viewer can engage visually and almost finish those sentences off. Because of that, I always think it's like a sculpture, like you've got a big slab of marble and you're pounding it into some kind of submission and eventually it will turn out to be something. Sometimes it doesn't. It's not guaranteed, but most of the time something interesting comes of it. So I don't think you innovate anything by having a very well-trodden path. You're sticking to the rules so much that nothing new will ever come of it because you know exactly what you're doing. If there's a sense of danger and challenge, especially at the beginning where you've got no preconceived ideas, something will happen that you haven't accounted for that just might be your springboard to your style or something tangibly different from the norm. So yeah, diving in, open mind, and like I say, that chaos, the chaos, especially at the beginning, seems to be, for me anyway, the way to go.
Well then, does that mean that, can I just call it your chaos layer? For your chaos layer, it's almost like you're inviting chaos. So magic can happen later, like you're leaving room for unexpected possibilities in your process, consciously.
Yeah, maybe there's different levels of chaos. It's funny because I'm aware when I say that to my students, you'll get some who go completely overboard. They might go too thick. They might use all kind of colors. But even that, I kind of think, you know what, something might happen. So my chaos tends to be, I'm very conscious that when I start something, I'm trying to contain my enthusiasm. I'm going to let it out a bit, but in spurts, if you like. So it's kind of this, I feel like I've got raging stallions in me that I'm trying to hold back so they don't go completely off on their own. So I'm completely aware that it's trying to form some kind of function, but I also want there to be enough of a possibility for it to deviate slightly from my long-term plan. When I bring the order in, everything stabilizes. An odd color might come through that I haven't accounted for, or marks that I might not account for, but I'm so engaged with it. And I know the chaos allows me to look at the painting more than the image, because I noticed when I used to do realistic work, I was so conscious of just constantly looking at the image and replicating it. Whereas when there's a bit of chaos, you kind of start looking at the mess you're making and the marks. And all of a sudden, something just subconsciously triggers a creative spin that it might take you somewhere. So yeah, the chaos layer is, there is some order behind it. It's not completely bonkers. So there's something there, but I'm allowing it to just run a little bit of amok before I put the leash on and hold it in place.
From the reference, are you bringing in a little bit in that first layer?
Okay, I tend to work from my own photos. So the advantage of that is I'm acutely aware of maybe the weather conditions when I took it. So I know the colors are more saturated, or I felt something as I took the photo, you know, maybe it was. So in a photo, you don't get a sense of wind maybe or temperature. You know, it's all subdued by the printing process or the camera. I'm actually consciously looking at the image. So if I'm doing some trees, for example, I'm going to use green if it's a summer tree, I suppose. If it's an autumnal, if it's starting to turn, I'll put some orange in the green. But what I'll do is I'll just heighten those colors a little bit more. Because I love Impressionism and Post-Impressionism, I like the optical color mixing effect where you put a little bit of purple next to a green. So what I might tend to do within the same brush, I might purple, orange, and green, and just drag that color down so I get a bit of an optical color mix. Rather than dab it next to each other, it's just coming through with one stroke. So it's not like I'm just making color up for the sake of it. I mean, that purple is there. As it blends with the green, it's going to go a bit browny anyway. And I like purple and green as colors. So I'm conscious that I'm using green and blue for the sky, but I might just enhance it with something. just to make a mark that I'm interpreting the scene. And sometimes actually, for example, if I'm on holiday or if I'm particularly angry and I'm painting a scene, I might want to convey that in the way I use color. But it's never kind of blatant. You know, I'm not going to do red paintings because I'm angry. It's going to be red in order to add some emotional content to the color mixes so they contrast off another color. And that can be problematic only because you need to know a little about color mixing and balance it and stuff like that. But yeah, in general, yeah, quite a few colors just to see how they behave.
Well, because I want to ask about this because, and also I'll link, you have a great YouTube channel where you have some of your demos on there and it's so great to see. So you work on a round palette, you lay out all your colors, and then you just start in.
Yeah, I have some, it's called a radial palette. And the good thing about this palette is it's got deep wells. So for example, watercolor palettes don't have deep wells. In fact, the palette I use is a watercolor palette, but I don't see a lot of watercolorists use it. So anything with a deep well means you can really fill that up with paint. So for example, when I start off, all my preparation is done beforehand, all my paints are set out. I'm not going to reload. I'm not going to worry anything about whether I'm running out or anything. So it's loaded. I also get a lot of the painting done in the first hour because I'm using quite a bit of paint. I'm using it fairly neat. So some of the first layers, that's it. I'm not going back to them. I'm not going to work on them. I'll just pepper highlights and maybe enhance them a little bit. So that's where I save paint because I'm not going back and then layering some more. It's a very instantaneous process of painting. So yeah, radial palette, lots of paint, and I just dab into the paint, lift it out, dab into another one, lift that one out. So there's no stirring or anything. Literally just dabbing in. I've got a plastic white mixing tray. I might just test a color briefly, but I understand that as I drag my loaded brush on the canvas, there's going to be some mixing going on as I apply the pressure. So in essence, I want some of that pure color to sing a little bit. There's some natural color mixing going on because it's organic. I hate grinding color to a pulp and then putting it on. So there's got to be something in there where the color sings. It's the nature of acrylic because it dries darker, and excessive work over acrylic or into acrylic will dull the color. So some of that purity, the streaks through and the under mixing allows the color to function on a slightly higher level. It's all going to dull down slightly anyway, but it just allows for some of the purity of the color. Certainly up close, if you were to look at one of my paintings up close, you'll see some of those streams of pure color coming through. It's hopefully fairly subtle, but yeah, there's not a lot of kind of stopping and starting. Go straight in.
When you say you mix it neat or you lay it down neat, what does that mean?
Okay, I've noticed when I first started with acrylics, lots of acrylic artists were using them like glorified watercolors. So they would dilute the brush, pick up color, a couple of colors, mix it to a pulp, put it on. I initially started doing that and then I realized, well, the color's dying. Why is it dying? Because it's kind of, I'm over mixing or over diluting. So I just felt the unique selling point to some extent with acrylics is if you don't play with them and you pick up paint relatively neat and you undermix them and then you apply the paint, you'll actually get quite a bit of fizz from the color. I've actually heard this from some oil painters who say don't overmix. Amateur artists tend to overmix everything and it goes dull or add too much water. But acrylics especially, if you undermix them and apply them, you'll get a lot more kind of bang for your buck, if you like, because some of that color will, some of the rich color will work off some of the duller color that might come later, or you accidentally mixed. If you mix a lot of colors on your brush, you will mix some fairly neutral shades. You'll get the essence of some of the purity of the color that streaks through, and it will just lift and elevate the colors around it a little bit more.
Well, then I should say, like, you're using a flat, large brush for this. So you're getting really hard, squarish angles.
Yeah. When I started painting this way, I definitely learned off Impressionism because at that time, that's when the flathead, squarehead brush started being utilized in a very big way. So it's one of the reasons why when you look at Impressionist work, there's a very distinct dab mark. So I naturally just tuned myself to an implement, a flathead brush, if you like, that made a very, very conscious mark. I started off fairly small. I even started using a Filbert, which is Filbert or Bright. with a slightly rounded head, but I definitely like the flat head because it gives me a very definitive mark. And even at the end, if I twist it a little bit, I'll get a bit of a circular shape from it. So that contrast between a very concise flat and something slightly more rounded, I find that quite palpable as a difference in the painting. And I just like, if you use a big brush as well, you can really load a lot of paint on that flathead brush. And as you apply it, you'll get that stream of color. I don't particularly like feathering, blending, because I think that's a technique best left to oil painters, because oil does that so well. Acrylics just start drying out on you. So if you start blending and feathering too much, it just doesn't work as well. So that flathead brush, you're actually playing up the mark rather than trying to polish it off. That mark is meant to be definitive as you apply the paint.
You try to cover the whole canvas with bold marks and local-ish color. How then do you begin to sculpt toward completion? Do you work dark to light? And then at what point do you really consciously start thinking about shapes?
Normally, the end is a lot more to do with dark and light, because I can make it look three-dimensional with my extremes of dark and my very strong highlights. So just in terms of making everything balanced, mid-tones are a good place to start, but probably halfway through, I'll start adding some definition. And by the end, I really want to crystallize some differences between some shapes and bring out focal points. It's really tricky sometimes to be definitive about the kind of recipe that you use, because there's going to be some paintings where inadvertently you might just go in darker or lighter. But I know I might initially use some color to distinguish some shapes. So I might look at cool colors to put everything in the shadow, maybe mixed with a little bit of burnt sienna or some gray just to create an earthy look to it. And I'm more conscious where the light is striking an element that's going to be kind of yellows, kind of warm colors. So at the end, I'll start maybe covering up some of those yellows with more normal tints, if you like, natural-looking tints. But that fizzing yellow underneath will just give it the heightened look of heat. And the cool colors will have darker tones, maybe more naturalistic, but that blue will still simmer to give the color aspect to it. So yeah, normally color first to distinguish some of the shapes, with a bit of earthy, neutral browns. But at the end, it becomes more of a tonal range that I look for.
So it really is, it's like mid-tones, a bunch of color thinking, and then the end is bringing in those extreme contrasts of value.
Yeah, I've been dictated to a little bit by my commercial work, because I'm very conscious that when you go into a gallery, you want to catch someone's attention. So let's say your work is on the far wall and you want it to call out to someone, you're going to use color, or you're going to use tone, or both. So I didn't want to go timid, and I didn't want to go super soft with too many close tones. I wanted my painting to scream and shout from the far corner of the room. So I started using kind of very bright base colors, so they would simmer through. So I'd use strong complementary colors on top and then even it off with the tone. So my commercial work just informed me that, yeah, your paintings are meant to make a statement. I've noticed with clients I've worked for, generally, people don't look at paintings close up. It's on their wall. It's 5 feet away. Maybe it's in a darkened room. And that's going to make you a little bit more conscious of shooting up the values, just so even in a slightly more darkened room, it's still got something to say and it's going to stand out a little bit. I had a really lovely message from a lady I did some work for. She bought one of my paintings. And when she gets up every morning, down her hallway is one of my paintings. And it's a very, very bright woodland scene. But she told me the fact that it's a woodland scene was neither here nor there. It's just every morning she has this long walk from her bedroom down the corridor. And at the end of the corridor is my painting shouting colors at her. Maybe that's too extreme. You know, it's certainly just saturating her perception with color first thing in the morning, so she feels more awake.
Your work really walks that abstraction representational line. What do you need to get accurate so that it reads as a street scene or trees, as opposed to reading as pure abstraction?
I think there's certain priorities in street scenes. For example, if you're looking down the street, you probably want to get a few perspective lines in. And I think the other thing is you can get hung up on everything, but there's certain things that we look at which prioritize over others. So for example, if you see someone walking down the street, The chances are you're going to look at the head and the shoulders, and it tends to be the outline, the silhouette of someone. And then you'll just soak up more information. So things like the silhouette of the buildings leading you down the street is more important than the information in the building. So if I was prioritizing, I'd say, okay, well, the top of the buildings leading me down the high street or any street is a bit of a priority. And then I might say, well, I don't want to put all the windows in, but I might prioritize certain ones maybe in the foreground. And it's similar with people. I'll pick on maybe a few of the figures and I'll pick out maybe a highlight on the top of their heads and their shoulders. But it's very rarely I'll do like feet or shoes, shoelaces. If you put a few creases in, those diagonals will communicate that there's a bit of motion going on. But I've found that you can put too much information in and there's this information overload going on where there's no space for that really important information to breathe. Certainly, the more painting I do, I'm trying to relate that better, have the calm areas, and then the very, very acutely important lines and marks, which definitely take longer than everything else. You could have like a group of people and they could take longer than the entire painting if you're going to make something of them. But I find that once I've got the momentum of the coverage, then I don't mind investing some time in pinpointing information that's going to create these little stepping stones of elements that lead you down the street. So some cars, yeah, whatever you can prioritize rather than just putting everything in just for the sake of it.
So you said you don't draw for these paintings, but how important is your drawing skills to create the work that you do?
It's really important. I'd definitely be a completely different artist if from the start I did just abstracts or whatever. I can't do it pure abstract anyway, because I find it quite difficult not having a representational image to work from. The weird thing about drawing, it's not purely so you can draw something accurately. It's so you can distill the information and you can look at proportions of things and the scale of something. So when you do whatever painting you're doing, you can at least get the shapes in some kind of order. So you get the eyes in the right place for portrait sort of thing. I mean, I've tried really hard, actually, to try to draw badly in order to make my paintings look a bit more interesting, because I love naive art, for example, and I love that play of perspective. And I think part of the problem, for example, if you draw a lot, you're going to be fixated by it because it's just so logical. Everything makes sense. Everything's in the right place. When I get architects coming to my workshops, they are obsessed with straight lines, all the windows. They've got no sense of like the atmosphere or just working off the fact that someone's looking at your paintings and they want to engage with it. So not sledgehammering everything. But the drawing is vital so you can, like I say, distill the information and kind of to some extent grind it in your creative brain so it comes out so you've interpreted it rather than just copied and replicated something.
But also I hear you saying that drawing ability allows you to have some realism anchored into a space that has chaos so that it can still bring your viewer through it as opposed to losing your viewer. It's the drawing that allows you to make that, you know, the silhouette of the shoulder accurate so that everything else on that shoulder can be inaccurate.
Yeah. So I'm very conscious when people look at my work for the first time, they have a perception that it's realistic. When they look at it up close, it's blocks, next to a bigger block. It just so happens that I've tried to nail where I guess the accurate portrayal of a human being or a building or a car just happens to be with being economical with the amount of marks I use. So I find it now really hard to stop myself. And given the opportunity, I do detail. And it's like you become addicted to doing it because your subconscious just takes a back seat as you're just on autopilot, filling more and more information in. The only thing I've noticed with drawing, though, and I think it's any mindset that you have where you've invested a certain amount of time perfecting something, I definitely think you need an overview of when you use something. And it could be someone who's spent a lot of time using color or design. You still need to step out of that to re-engage with the other component parts. I mean, I'm really grateful for all the illustration I did because it was relentlessly drawing accurately. You know, if I did some advertising campaign, it was every minute little thing. So I became very, very conscious of like the whole thing needs to be so precise, because you'd get some exec saying, hang on, that thumb isn't right, or whatever it might be. So I'm grateful. And I think drawing in general is really important. Some of the best abstract painters are the best drawers. It's just they don't want to relate to a complete representational scene, but they've been patient enough to build up that skill so they can look at something and break it down so completely into the essence.
If someone came to you and said, I want to get really good at painting, what advice do you give them?
Yeah, you know, I think it really helps to look at lots of different artists, lots of different styles. I mean, I learned this after I left college. I actually got really enthused by looking at some art history, a lot of art history, because they just weren't painting for the sake of it. They were painting and reflecting the times that they were living in. And I thought that was really valuable, because you then associate art as a vehicle to have a voice in something. So I think if you're starting out, I don't think you should just be narrow-minded in thinking, I'm going to learn the mechanics of painting and I'm literally just going to crank out one scene after the other. Because you actually want to use it as a, like I say, as a bit of a voice visually anyway, to just put across a point of view, even if you are painting a lovely harbor scene. And I think the worst thing you can do for anyone actually starting out is send them down the wrong path of only thinking, right, the way I do it is the right way, and we're going to all do a step-by-step showcasing what I've learned and my journey. So I don't think that's helpful. So I think just being open-minded. And actually, I think when you're young, actually, you're so impressionable, or when you're starting out, should I say, in art, when you're very impressionable, you might end up with someone who's just going to be, do what I say, do what I do. So I think, yeah, looking at different art, soaking up lots of different artists' styles. There's so much opportunity now online. You can or go to an exhibition and just see what's out there. You'll find someone probably closely aligned to what you think. And hopefully that will then have a knock-on effect and springboard something of your interpretation and your voice, rather than, like I say, copying too much of someone else's.
You can learn more about Hashim Akib at his website, www.hashimakib.co.uk, and on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. And we'll link to everything in the show notes. Thank you so much for being with us today, Hash.
Thank you so much, Kelly. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for joining me this week on the podcast 50th episode. Head to learntopaintpodcast.com/podcast/episode50 for show notes. And if you'd like to join the podcast art club on Patreon, head to learntopaintpodcast.com/art club to learn more. And one more thing, if you like the show and think it might be valuable to others learning to paint, click like on your listening app. And if you've got a few more moments to spare for an extra episode 50 celebration, leave a review of the show. Reviews especially let iTunes know that it should share the show with others, and it makes a big difference. Speaking of big, big differences, thank you to everyone supporting the show and the Podcast Art Club on Patreon. You make the show possible. An extra shiny thank you to High Gloss Friends, Andrew Atterbury, Debbie and Brian Miller, Rihanna DeRold, Janet Wheeler, Nancy Bryant, Catherine Ordway, and Pam Lyle. Happy painting!